Thought we set it on the counter, the table. Okay. Good evening. My name is Julie. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Julie.
Thank you, Barb, for asking me. I had not anticipated that I would be doing this service. I didn't have a lot of time to obsess about it. I actually did some four-step work and took a nap, so I should be raring to go. I started coming to meetings at Easter of 1987, and when I was driving over here, I came kind of a backwards way, and I drove past where my office used to be. And Tuesday, I will have had the same job for 29 years, and I thought there's two things I've done consistently for more than 20 years: my job and coming to meetings. And that I believe they go hand in hand. I probably would not have been able to keep the job had it not been for the things that I learning to live my life through the 12 steps. I am the eldest of two children, and I was the first grandchild on both sides, and I was probably pretty willful even then. When my grandmother was alive, they laugh about a story. My folks have always lived here, and there used to be a steakhouse down on Center Street, if you know where Saddle Creek and Center is, there by Hy-Vee and the Walgreens, before they changed the neighborhood many years ago. This has got to be 62, 63. And one of my grandmothers desperately wanted to have dinner there. And, of course, because they had no one else, we all went. And I threw such a fit that they had to leave and eat in a restaurant owned by a member of the family. So I was pretty strong-willed if I could get all of those adults to agree to do what I wanted. And looking back now, I don't think I had the problem with obesity as a child that I see in kids now, but I was definitely on the heavier side, and there was always a concern about my weight. But I wasn't, you know, one of those kids, fortunately, that was 150 pounds by the time they were in the fifth grade, but I was always on the bigger side and a little bit socially awkward. I have a sister that's 2.5 years younger than I am, and we're not maturity in my family, I think, is hard to come by. My parents lived with my grandmother until my sister was born, and then we moved into the house where my mother lived up until this fall, and they lived there for 8 years, and then my dad moved his mother in next door, so I always had a mother or a father or a grandmother or somebody there. And I remember that food was always a concern for my mom about what I was eating, and the pediatrician said she's too heavy. My mom said, "Well, I don't know what to do." And the doctor said, "Well, you're the adult; you buy the food." So there was always the cookies and things that were in the house were hidden, and boy, if I found them, there weren't any left. I don't remember hiding food or sealing it, but if I found, actively looking for it, but if we found it. If I found it, I shared it with my sister, and it was not. There was no such thing as, let's have one and have the rest later. We would eat them all until they were gone. I was, struggled socially throughout elementary school, and we had some craziness at home. My dad was a practicing alcoholic for as long as I can remember. He didn't view himself that way because he got up and went, he never said he never missed a day of work because he was drinking. He didn't hit his wife and his kids, which is an entirely other story. It's interesting how people remember, how you can talk to five or six different people and everybody remembers a particular incident differently. And there was a lot of tension in the home with his when he moved his mother in next door to us. She was not particularly fond of my mother and made it very clear that that was the case. And I feel badly for my mom because I think she deserved a lot better than she got. But anyway, I went away to high school and I was still just a little bit heavier than everybody else. Not the fattest girl in the class, but weight was always an issue, and finding appropriate clothes wasn't easy because I'm short and I tend to carry my weight in a place where I'm almost as big, I can be almost as big this way as I am this way. And I finished high school, I went to college for a couple of years, and again, still weight was an issue. And when I was in high school. I've been an asthmatic my entire life, and when I was in high school, I decided that it would be smart to start smoking, and yeah, that wasn't the best, one of my better choices, and I really started to have an issue with weight after I finished high school and was going to college. I got picked up probably, 40 or 50 pounds, which on somebody my height shows up pretty quick. And I was smoking real heavy. I went out of town with some friends to a football game in Kansas City and got desperately, desperately ill and was hospitalized down there. I had probably the worst asthma attack of my entire life. And the doctors were treating my asthma with steroids, and I knew about steroids and what they could do to your weight. A friend of mine that was with me when I was sick in Missouri had lupus and was treated with steroids, and so I knew what it could do to your appetite and what it could do to your body. And all I thought of is, I have an excuse now to eat whatever I want, whenever I want, and blame it on the medicine. And I probably, over the course of about a year and a half or 2 years, gained between probably 100 and 150 pounds, just ate like there was no tomorrow, just ate. I was in and out of the hospital. The asthma was really bad. I was in the hospital in 80 and 81, a couple times in 82, I think two or three times in 83 and 84, and I wasn't getting any better. And I want to say the spring of 1987, I was in the hospital, and they decided to do a, they weren't doing sleep studies at that time, or they didn't do one for me, but they put a little thing on my finger, and they said that they thought I wasn't breathing at night, but they didn't do the whole sleep study with like they do now. And I asked the doctor, I said, well, what can we do? Because I was already taking a lot of pills. I was doing breathing treatments. And he said, well, you know, the only thing that successfully treats this is, according to his, was to lose weight. And I'm like, oh, God, I don't. And I had tried periodically. I had gone to Weight Watchers off and on from the time I was probably 17 or 18. You know, I could lose 10 or 15 pounds, but could never stay with it. And, you know, I just struggled, lose it, gain it, up, down, and progressively just more miserable in my life. You know, was flunking out of college. When I got sick, and it was right around the finals time, and I was in the hospital, I came back, and I couldn't go back to school right away. And so it was at Christmas time, and it was the semester break, and I had a teacher said, well, you know, the school said, well, we'll let you take your finals. We'll give you X number of weeks. I ended up taking finals for the winter, the fall quarter and the spring quarter all at the same time, classes that I hadn't been in probably in, since September, and I'm taking the final for them in March or April, so that wasn't real good. And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to go back to school, but all I really wanted to do was get out of school, find some kind of a job, and be an adult, whatever that meant. And so I was looking for a job, and I fortunately found one, and in and out of the hospital, barely kept the job, in and out of the hospital all the time, not getting any better. The asthma's getting worse, the weight's coming on. I'd lost about 40 pounds in 86, boom, put it right back on, and probably 20 more. And when I got out of the hospital in 87, and the doctor said, he said, the asthma's not going to kill you, the fork will. He said, I can't, you know, your asthma's not stable enough to take you off steroids, but I'm concerned because your weight is ballooning. And, you know, he said, let me send you to weight reduction program they have at Clarkson Hospital and see, and perhaps they can give you some information about nutrition. And I went a couple times, and it wasn't anything I hadn't already learned through Weight Watchers, through a program I'd done when I was in my teen years at Children's Hospital. I mean, I knew, I wouldn't say I was a walking book about nutrition, but I knew basic portion size. I knew you've got to be mindful of movement and stuff. And I remember going, and I was still gaining weight, looking at this woman and said, you know, I don't know what I'm doing here, why we're even doing this, because I'm wasting your time and my money and my insurance company's money. I said, I don't really want to be here. I don't know if I'm going to come back. My neighbor, my mom's neighbor at the time, was a friend of mine, and she had lost a tremendous amount of weight very quickly through a pay and weigh, and hit the goal on the pay and weigh and could not keep the weight off. And she and I were pretty close, and I knew that her dad had gotten sober in AA, and she was going to OA meetings. This was back in 85, and she said, why don't you come to a meeting with me? So I was open to almost anything, and I said, sure, I'll go. And I went to the meeting, and you know how they tell you 6 meetings? Yeah, well, I didn't do 6. I did 1, and I was not ready to come back. Roll the calendar forward a couple of years. I'm barely hanging on to my job. I can't find appropriate clothes to fit. Fortunately, my company was liberal and had no dress code at the time, so I could wear the same 3 or 4 pairs of jeans I had and a t-shirt to work every day. And I was absolutely miserable. I had no, you know, I was living at home. I wasn't getting along with my folks. I had no social life other than eating. I had befriended some people who, gee, imagine that, ran a restaurant. So I could have dinner at home with my family and then go and visit my friends in the restaurant, and they'd feed me again. And I thought I had it made. And of course, you had to feel sorry for me because I was in and out of the hospital. I was wheezing like a broken calliope, smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day, and my life was absolutely, positively miserable. So I left the, I forget what Clarkson called the program, I left it and I went to the, and I called my neighbor and I said, Elise, are you still going to meetings? And she said, no, I'm not. And I said, do you have a meeting list? And she said, well, call the number in the phone book. So I called the number in the phone book, and I have a very dear friend that I don't keep in good contact with who's one of those people that will do anything with you. And I called her up, and her brother had gotten sober through and clean from drugs and sober through 12 steps, so she was familiar. And she said, yeah, Julie, I'll go with you. That meeting doesn't meet anymore. It was out at Faith Westwood Church out in Miller. And all I remember is what shoes everybody had on, because I sat off to the side and looked at everybody's shoes. And I know it was Easter because there was a lady that was talking about how the Easter candy was torturing her. And I didn't really particularly like it, but I also knew I didn't have any place else to go. So I toyed around with, was I going to go back? And finally I got the nerve to decide that I could go find a different meeting and I could go by myself. So I went to Thursday night meeting, and in those days, Thursday night was perfect for somebody like me that wasn't sure they really wanted to be there, because there was about 60 or 70 people. And I could slip in the door and sit. I sat in the far back corner, and I'd even tell people what my name was, because in the type of work that I have, when I started doing it, they'd give the baby book and pass it around the classroom, and if there was another person working there that had your name, you got to pick a name out of a baby book, or you could, pick your favorite TV show. So anyway, I used a different name at work, and I used it so often, people thought it was my name, and they called me by that name. So, and I would answer to it. I would get mail at work addressed that way, and so I thought, well, if I don't really want anybody to know who I am, I'll be the last one in the door. I sat in the chair closest. They've changed a little bit how that church is set up, and I'd sit in the far back corner closest to the door. I didn't make eye contact with anybody. There were enough people there where I didn't have to worry about getting called on to read anything, or I wasn't about to volunteer. And I introduced myself by that name for probably close to a good 6 months. And that was the only meeting I went to. I didn't get a sponsor right away. And I finally got to the point where I thought, you really need to decide if this is what you're going to do. I knew that things could get better, and I saw people coming to me. I saw the people coming to the meetings every week, and I heard the things that how people's lives has gotten better. And I thought, well, when is this going to happen to me? And a little voice in my head said, well, it's not going to happen to you if you're going to sit in the far back corner of the room and you're not going to tell anybody what your name is. And I had bought the books and I read them, but I wasn't comfortable enough to pick up the phone. And other than making the first phone call to find out where the meeting was, it was just all I could do to, come before literally 7:29:59. And not be out the door by, at that time the meeting would run for sometimes over an hour, hour and 15, hour and 20. We'd break up into 4 or 5 different small groups. And while the meeting supposedly was supposed to end at 8:30, well, by the time everybody got done sharing, depending on the size of the group, sometimes it was closer to 9 o'clock. And I would sit there and watch the clock. They're done. I can go. And finally, I got this message that said, if you don't reach out your hand to these people, you will not get any better, and it's another waste in your time. So I got a sponsor. My first sponsor is no longer in the fellowship. I unfortunately can't tell you what happened to her. I haven't seen her in a long, long time. Out of the people that were coming to meetings then, there are less than five that are still coming now, which, you know, kind of really makes me sad. I wonder, you know, did they all get graduated? Did they get cured? I don't know, but they're not here. Doesn't matter. I'm here and you're here. I came in weighing about 230, and I got rid of my weight about a year. And I am embarrassed to admit I did not work the steps. I didn't work the program. I might as well have been going to a pay and weigh, because I wasn't really talking about what was going on for me. But I could, you know, it's that will that we have. You throw, you know, people made suggestions as far as what to eat. And I came for the vanity, and that's what I got. I came because I wanted to get rid of my weight. And I heard about people's lives getting better, but I was more focused on, well, it's nice that your life's better, but how much weight have you lost, and how do you eat? And those questions, and I found a food plan that worked, because I literally hung on white knuckle tight and got the weight off, but I got very little spiritual or emotional recovery. And the sponsor I was working with at that time, I put on a pedestal, and we all know what happens when you do that. And we had a parting of the ways, and I was really, really sick and did some really awful things and walked away. And didn't come to meetings for, sporadically attended meetings off and on for a couple of years. And I lost probably 120 pounds, and I stayed at that weight for, maybe 4 or 5 weeks, and the weight started to climb again. And I was so mad at anything to do with the 12-step program. I was convinced it was a cult, and I was never going to go back. And, you know, I had this thing licked, and okay, so I picked up a little bit of weight. It's just a little bit. And threw myself into my work. I had always questioned my sexuality for a long time and thought, okay, well, I'll date someone and things will get better. So I dated a man for a while and then dated another one and then lived with one for a while. And the entire time I was getting bigger and bigger and crazier and crazier. And I had a very dysfunctional relationship with my folks. I lived at home. I followed in the family tradition. I lived at home until I was, I think, 34 or 35. And I moved less than a mile from my parents when I finally did move out. And, you know, I wouldn't change any of that time for the world, because I did learn a lot about myself in that period of time. But I was really, really, really sick. And I lived with a man for about a year and a half. And I thought that if I got married, that would fix me. And he must have sensed that that wasn't going to fix me. And I was really sick. And so we had one big blowout, and he packed his stuff and left. It was like, now I can be who I am. And I had started to reach out. I'd run into people from meetings here and there, and I finally decided to, you know, I woke up one day and I was like, this is not getting any better. And I had a closet full of clothes that didn't fit, and I was absolutely positively miserable, and I thought, what are you going to do about this? You know, I had lost, I'd gained probably half the weight, if not more of it back. I was just miserable. I literally lived to go to work. Lived to go to work. That was about all there was. And this little voice said, you probably should think about going back to meetings. And so I'd show up at a meeting, and then you might not see me for 4 or 5 weeks. And I wasn't going to talk to you, but I was going to come. And I was kind of easy for me to kind of slide in, because the people that had been here before, well, for the most part, weren't here, so I could be like a newcomer. And I never introduced myself as a newcomer, but I knew that I had to. And I'd like to tell you that I got better right away when I started coming back to meetings, but that didn't happen either. I stayed in relapse. I continued to go to meetings. I stayed in relapse, and I was so wrapped up in my work. I had some wonderful opportunities. I was gone for some time working away, and I was eating. You know, I ate my way. I lived in St. Thomas, and I ate and gained weight while I was going to meetings, supposedly working a program. Did the same thing in Aruba. When I was in Aruba 10 years ago, I like that this is probably not an appropriate joke, but I'm living proof. If you go to Aruba and you don't get in a car with a stranger, you're going to come home. I came home. I didn't get in any car with any strangers, and I came home. While I was living in Aruba, I was getting, emotionally and spiritually, I was getting better, but I couldn't get my hands on the food, and I just, I was living in a hotel. I had car. They really didn't care what I did as long as I showed up for work. So, if I could, it was heaven or hell on earth, depending upon what day it was, how I was feeling at any particular time. I was going to meetings and eating full force. I had a big book that has probably as many stamps and should be stamped like my passport that I took with me. But I was going to meetings, but I can't tell you, I was working a program, and I picked up the phone one day. I would call home every day from Aruba, and I called home, and my mom said, your dad's sick. And I said, well, what's wrong with him? She said, well, he said he wanted to go to the doctor, so I took him to the doctor, and it doesn't sound very good. And I said, what do you mean it doesn't sound very good? And she said, well, they wanted to do a colonoscopy, but they couldn't do it. And he's going to go and have surgery. This was on Tuesday, and she said, on Thursday. And I said, how long have you known about this? And she said, oh, about a week or a week and a half. But you know, it's your job, and we don't want you to come home. You just don't come home. You know, you committed that you'd go and you'd stay from August until December, so you got to stay. And so I didn't go home because I didn't know how sick my dad was. He went in for surgery in October, and they told my mom after surgery that there was nothing they could do for him. He had stage 4 colorectal and liver cancer. And the only reason they did surgery is because the tumor was so large that they had to do a colostomy, because otherwise it would have killed him. And so they didn't tell me this on the phone. They said, oh, he's sick, but we're going to, he'll get some chemo, and we think everything will be okay. So I figured, well, if that's the case, I'm not going to come home. It's nice. It's really easy to be in denial when you're 3,000 miles away and virtually no idea what's going on. I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to go to meetings when I was in Aruba. There was a lady that was a transplant from Germany who would come to the hotel every single Tuesday and pick me up and take me to the meetings. They had very little literature. They didn't have a meeting format. Somebody was sending them lifelines, and that's what they used for their meeting topics, and they were thrilled to have me. There was a gentleman who was a transplant from Chicago, and his wife, who was Aruban, and he married and moved there with her, this German lady and I, and they were thrilled to have me. And I continued to go to meetings and eat, and that's a hard thing to say. I went to meetings and I ate, and I came home from Aruba, and my sponsor sister picked me up at the airport because my mom was busy with him. I didn't know how sick my dad was, and I came home. If he had not been in my mother's house, I would not have recognized him. He was a changed man, and literally from the time I left in August until I came home in December. And I did the only thing I knew how to do. I ate and ate and ate, and he was really, really sick. It was a really, really rough time, and I wish that I could say that I'd used the steps and the tools to get me through it, but I'm going to be honest with you, I didn't. I ate. And he didn't talk about anything, and I didn't talk about anything, and my mom didn't talk about anything, but we knew that it was very obvious this man was dying. And I went off on another short trip, and came home, and they had moved him to hospice care. And I remember I was going to meetings this whole time, making phone calls, but could not stop eating. And there were several times where I thought, I can remember sitting in the Thursday night meeting and thinking, I can stop at Baker. I used to live on 72nd Grover, and I would stop and get food on the way home from the meeting. I didn't eat. And that hour from 7:30 to 8:30 was probably the only time that I wasn't eating. But I was still going to meetings. I kept coming back. I would tell you, if nothing else, keep coming back, because eventually you get it. I went on a short trip. My dad went to hospice. I was anxious to get. I did not want to go on this trip. I didn't was prepaid. My mom's like, you pay for it, you got to go. You know, the whole money thing. Oh, don't lose money. Oh, so what happens if dad dies while I'm gone? Well, you know he's going to die anyway, so what does it matter? Okay, so, well, anyway, I went. And it was the worst time. I'd call home, can I talk to him? No, he's sleeping, and this and that. Well, he got moved out of the house and into hospice. And when I came home, he said he waited. They asked him, you know, they told him it was okay to go. And he said, no, I'm waiting till Julie's going to come home. I want to see her. He lived another 2 weeks after that. The most shaming thing for me in all of this is that we are not a family to sit in the hospital or hold somebody's hand or sit by their bedside. That's just not, we're just not that way. I'm not even now with my mom. Anyway, he was up at the hospice house by Bergen, and my mom had been up there all day, and I wasn't working, and I had spent the day with a friend, and I came home, and I said, you know, we knew he was going to die, so I'd taken the time off work, and I said, you know, Mom, why don't you go home? You're probably really tired. You've been here all day. I didn't give a shit if she was tired or not. Dead men are not going to talk. I knew I could eat there, and nobody would know it. Nobody would see it. So I scooted her off home, and I hit Taco Bell a couple times and came and sat there. And instead of sitting there and being there for my dad the last night, I was there to eat. And, you know, that's the really crappy part of this disease. And he died on a Thursday, and I could have gone to a meeting on Thursday night. I went out, and I did the only thing I knew how to do. I ate. And that continued for another 2 years. I was going to meetings. I wasn't doing very much service. If he handed me something, I'd read it. I had a sponsor pretty much in name only who I would call, and she knew I was eating, and I knew I was eating. And, you know, her standard answer was, keep coming back. Just keep coming back. And I kept coming back. And can I tell you what turned the page for me? You know, I don't know. I got sick and tired of being sick and tired. I was to the point where I was living in an apartment where I had to walk from the parking lot up not steep steps, but gradual steps. If my phone was ringing and I could hear it ringing, there was no way I was going to get up to answer that phone when I could hear it, because I couldn't walk. I mean, my knees hurt. I was, my asthma was decidedly better, but still taking steroids to treat it. It was better control. But I knew things had to, I kept thinking, Julie, you're either going to do this or you're going to, you know, what is OA to you, a social outlet? Because you're really not doing anything else. Finally, can I tell you what flipped the switch? No. All I know is I decided I wanted to change how I was feeling. And maybe if I ate a little different and did some exercise, I would feel better. Didn't think about the steps, you know, just done it. It's that vanity thing. And started to do a little bit of that and felt a little better. And this voice kept saying, pick up the book. You go to the meetings. You're sitting in the meetings and you're talking about tools. And you're talking about, you know, literature. And you're going to meetings. It's time to work the program. And I finally decided, you know, I got to save my own life. I'm not going to get this by osmosis. I've got to start working the steps. Called the sponsor that I was working with and said, you know, I want to do this. And started to feel better. Things started to turn around, but it was still real gradual. I was still playing around with food a little bit. You know, meeting attendance was pretty consistent, and finally one day I got up and I looked in the mirror and I said, now, it's now or never. You're going to do this or you're not. And I made a big step. I changed sponsors. God loved the sponsor I was working with. I had been in the place I was with her before, and I knew I needed to make a strong change. If I did not make a strong change, I wasn't going to get any better. And I don't want, you know, I'm not blaming any sponsor or anyone. It was just, I was real comfortable and I needed somebody that could challenge me in a different light. And I really wanted to get better. And I said to myself, Julie, because I dropped a little bit of weight and I was feeling a little better. And I thought, I'm doing really well, you know. I'm wearing clothes I bought 12 years. It's a good thing I never threw anything away. I've got, I looked at the pants I put on today, and I thought, I bought these when I was in Hawaii 10 years ago. But they didn't fit for 10 years, but they fit now. You know, I went to meetings in other cities and, you know, was hearing the message. And I was thinking, I'm going to get this. You know, it was almost like someday I'm going to get this. Someday I'm really going to get this. Because I couldn't, you know, I couldn't muster a day with imagining being on a food plan or following through with anything. All I could ever do, right, was going to meetings. And I, the kind of work I do, I can listen to music and stuff during the day. And I had bought an iPod and I had stumbled across 12-step speakers. So I started listening to them. And I started listening to some speakers, and I thought, you know what, Julie, you're going to get this. You're going to get it this time. You know, you're going to get it this time. And I finally just threw myself down and said, I will do whatever it takes. You know, I've got to do. I felt like I was on this big dividing line, and half of me was in the disease. And on Thursdays and Saturdays, I was in recovery because I go. Those were my meeting nights. You know, and it's like, do you really want to live in this suspended place where you want to be in recovery and you want to be normal, but you want to have a better relationship with food, but you only want to do it on Thursday and Saturday? And are you looking at OA as a social outlet again or as a means to get better? So I got a new sponsor. I've had more emotional and spiritual growth in the last probably 18 months than I did from 1987 coming forward, you know, and I am very grateful for the people that were there to open the door and set up the chairs in 1987 and those that were kind and welcomed me back at a time where I try to be conscious when I sit in a meeting now, and I was sitting in the meeting this morning and I noticed that how receptive am I to somebody talking to me and being open to a message when I have my arms crossed and I'm looking, glaring at you across the table. And I caught myself doing that this morning upstairs. I had my arms crossed, and I make it a consistent effort to sit up and be open and attentive and try to look people in the eye. It doesn't always work that way because I can, there was a lot of years where I was physically in the meeting, I was sitting here. I could tell you who was here, but could I tell you what was said or what I felt? Absolutely not, because my mind was thinking, I wonder what we're going to do tonight. What would I like to have for dinner? And it was all of, you know, and that's not, that doesn't support the quality of life I want for myself. I have had some wonderful miracles of recovery here in the last few years. I've had some hard things that I think OA helped me get through. Losing my dad, I was, my parents are older. My mother is still living. She is 84, and she's not very politically correct, and she is, let's call a spade a spade. My mother's a racist and a bigot. My alternative lifestyle would not sit well with her. And I had decided that if she wasn't going to figure it out, I was not going to tell her. An angry and vindictive ex, I don't know if I want to say girlfriend, called my mother and outed me to my mother, who I had to sit my mother down before I had my employment anniversary a couple of years ago, where she was going to meet some of my coworkers and my boss in a social setting and tell my mother that my boss is black and that she needs to be mindful of what she says, because she tends to categorize people by their race or their ethnicity, and she doesn't say it in a politically correct manner. So I'm very mindful of who I introduce to my mother, because I would not want anyone to think that I share those same values. It's been a very big challenge for me not to, because when you grow up thinking, you're hearing on a consistent basis that a particular race, this is an attribute of a particular race, it's hard to shake. So I was very fearful of how my mother would react to this particular bit of information, and she took it very well. She said, we just won't tell anybody else. And I'm like, well, Mom, you know, they have probably, I thought, look at me, they've already figured it out. You know, I said, Mom, you're probably the only one that hasn't figured it out, but we won't. But her big concern was that we wouldn't tell anybody else. I don't have a very big family. I have one first cousin. I have one living. My mom has a brother. My dad was an only child. If my uncle hasn't figured it out, he's never going to get it. I have had some really good relationships in that time and some really bad ones. I'm fortunate enough to have a very loving and caring partner with a wonderful family who have openly embraced me into their family unit, and I'm very, very fortunate for that. Do I still struggle with food? You know what? Absolutely. Now I'm at that place where I'm trying to learn to live with food in a happy, joyous, and free manner. And it's not always easy, but I'm ever grateful for every single one of you, every single one of you that has been here to unlock the doors and set up the chairs and lead the meetings and work with the intergroup. I will tell you, service has kept me coming back when I thought nothing else would. I would tell you, throw yourself into service. Even if it's setting up chairs, it carries the message. And, you know, I'm not the best at making phone calls, but every once in a while I'll pick the phone up and make some calls. And, you know, to the newcomers here, you folks are probably the most important people here. So we've got to continue to carry the message. I do. It makes me sad to think that there were 70 people on a Thursday night, and now if we have 10, that's a big meeting. Can I tell you where all those people are? Absolutely not. Am I ever grateful that you guys are all here tonight? Absolutely. I can remember the shock when I was to go on Thursday night and there were six, you know, there'd be 60, 65 people, and I hadn't been to Thursday night in a while and walked in and there were 10. Where's everybody at? You know, but I have a power greater than, you know, can I tell you that it's God? I don't know. You know, I have that debate on a regular basis. I'm not active in the faith that I grew up in, but I do have a higher power, and I have begun to work it on spirituality in a forum that I'm comfortable with. And I never thought that I would, you know, go back to church. I went to more church in the last month than I have probably in the last 20 years. I had not gone to Mass since my dad passed away, except for one Mass I wanted to hear when I was in Hawaii, because they said it in Hawaiian. And my dad's aunt passed away about a month ago. I went to a rosary on Friday, a funeral on Saturday, and my church on Wednesday prior to that, and Sunday. I thought, there is, you know, I joked at work about the volcanic ash was a result of me having been in church, but I would tell you, I've had the gracious, good. I went to meetings when I was in Hawaii, I found a meeting. When I was in Aruba, I found a meeting. When I was in St. Thomas, I couldn't find an OA meeting, but I found an AA meeting. I took a job in New Jersey for a while and found a wonderful group of women that would, you know, come to the hotel and pick me up and take me to a meeting. And, you know, I would tell you that I've been fortunate enough to find this fellowship almost everywhere I've gone. And I was reflecting in 1992 or 93, I took a long trip for me, a couple weeks at that time, to Bermuda. And before I left, I looked, this is before the web and before computers were real common, and I picked up the phone and called this woman who was in the Navy and stationed in Bermuda and said, I'm going to call you every night for a week. I often wonder what happened to her. I have no idea. I didn't keep track of her after I left. But there's so many people that in this fellowship and others that, you know, have gotten me where I'm at now, and I'm in the process of finishing. I gave the topic of the meeting this morning about something, and I talked about how these numbers are all chasing me. You know, my weight isn't what I like, and I went and bought something, and it was one size 4 months ago, and now it's one part's bigger, but the other part's small, and all these numbers were chasing me, and I've been working on my fourth step and been delaying finishing it. I said, and now I've got the numbers 4 and 5 chasing me in my dreams. So, you know, hopefully this will be the push I need to get the fourth step finished and move forward. But I want to thank everybody who's here, and even those people that I've never met, the speakers that I listen to at work during the course of the day that, you know, have really made a difference for me. And, you know, I'm just anxious to know what's going to come in the next, you know, the first 27 years here have been, for the most part, the best, you know, the best years of my life. And I'm only, you know, I know we only have one day at a time, but I'm anxious to know what the next 24 hours is going to bring for me. So, well, my hour's almost up. More so. Thanks. Oh, there's questions. It's really hot in here. I'm really sure. If you're wearing a sweat, thank you. You're wearing a sweater, and I'm sweating like a...
We will now open the meeting to questions for the speaker. Please limit your questions to the speaker, Sharon, how she works the steps or uses the tools of recovery. We ask that you raise your hand and wait to ask your question when the speaker calls on you.
Jimmy, you have a question.
I have kind of a frivolous question. I want to know what your name was. Oh, because
it's so funny that, you know, when I came here, I stopped and bought some tea up there at that station on 90th, and I don't know where the lights are there by Razzie's. Imagine that. I know there's a restaurant nearby. I don't know what the gas station is, but no, Razzie's across the street. I came around down Bedford and back in there, and Marriott's Reservation Center used to be over there where West was, and I grew up watching soap operas with my mom and my grandma, and we used to watch As the World Turns and then Secret Storm, which is now gone, in The Guiding Light. And there was a character on The Guiding Light whose name was Morgan, and her character was dating Kevin Bacon at that time. And when they asked what my phone name wanted to be, because there was another girl that worked there that was named Julie, that's what it was. And people literally called me that, and I would answer to it. I mean, I had friends I worked with that called me. When I was living at home, we'd call my house and say, is Morgan there? And my mom would hand me the phone. So what do they call you? That was my phone name at work, and everybody calls me that. So I do much better with frivolous questions. Yes?
I'm curious what your food plan looks like now.
It's three moderate meals a day. I try to, if I'm going to go to the gym or do a lot of physical activity, I try to have a snack in the afternoon. Sugar is not a huge thing for me. I can have something sugar and walk away from it and not think about it for 6 months, but no fried foods. You know, it's very important for me to learn what appropriate portion size is. So I'm looking at the back of the, you know, I look at the label. There's some things I weigh. If I have, like, let's say almonds, I weigh them out, because to me, if this is the container, that my mind says that's the portion. So, you know, just make sure that it's something that's going to provide me with, when I look at something I'm going to eat, is it fueling my body to do what it needs to do, or is it feeding my mind? Is it feeding my obsession? Am I going to eat this today, and then on Wednesday, am I going to find myself at 10 o'clock at night thinking, I need to go to Hy-Vee to get light bulbs because I want whatever it is that I had a week ago that I haven't been able to get out of my mind? I think we can call. Oh, we have a question. Joe has a question. I knew I was.
Julie, I'm curious. You know, it's amazing. You can go to any program and hear your own story somewhere, you know. And yours and mine are so similar. How do you... It's pretty tough for me. It's how do you being an old-timer, but also being a newcomer? And, you know, and how do you work that together and stuff. You know, I know I have people approach me and think that I should know all the answers and stuff like that. You know, and I didn't get a grip till I'd been coming here for 17 years, you know, and so people thought I had all this knowledge and I didn't, and, you know. So how do you just be a overeater and just not be the guru?
I don't often, I don't know that anybody knows that I've been coming that long. I don't know how many people knew that. I just would say keep coming back, and that's, you know, and you can't ever know all of it, because I don't have an answer for you except that I just kept coming back, and I don't, I respect that length of time doesn't mean that you know everything, you know. I've learned that in my job, I've learned that here. Just because I've been coming to meetings for 27 years doesn't mean I'm well, And, you know, it's just, I just kept coming back, and I was open to listening to what other people have to say, and I listened, you know, I just keep coming back. I just tell people, you know what, I would tell you, keep coming back. I thought I knew it all. Yeah, when I lost 110 pounds, I thought I knew everything. Well, you know, I didn't. I knew a lot about how to follow a food plan and how much strength that takes, and I knew nothing about emotional recovery and nothing about spiritual recovery. How many of us in this room can say we've had a period where we thought we knew everything and our weight was stable and we were thinking things were pretty good, but there was always that little thing in the back of your mind that's, how long is this going to last? How long is it going to last? How long can I pull this off? So, hope that answers your question, Joe. I've learned over time it's much better to be in just another bozo on the bus. You know, just be another bozo on the bus. If somebody asks me how long I've come to meetings, I will tell them. But, you know, I used to joke with my former sponsor, and we still joke with this tonight. There were times when, if I was nothing else, it was a very good, bad example. You know, and there's no, I am not, you know, I'm not cracking on myself or, you know, making light of it. I was a very good, bad example. And I just think, if I could tell anybody, this is what happens when you go to meetings and you do nothing else but go to meetings. You don't pick up the phone, you don't look at the books, and you, in the back of your mind, think, yeah, well, I've heard all this before, and I'm just going to hang out because I want to know how X, Y, or Z's, you know, I kind of like our fall retreat speaker said sometimes that I came just to know if your life was getting any better, because mine sure wasn't, but maybe yours was, so. We have another, Dayla has a question.
I know that this is a program of action, and, you know, and I think you illustrated in your story that you took a lot of no action, and, mm-hmm. you know, that you finally added action into your program. I also know enough about you to know that you have put a lot of physical activity in just recently. Has that helped you in your emotional recovery and your spiritual recovery also?
Yes, because I'm not... I have had asthma my entire life, and one of the things that I learned very young is it's a really good way not to have to do anything physical, really physical. And, you know, so it has really, I have struggled with trying to learn how to run. I had a trainer a couple of years ago that I worked with who was very supportive of whatever I was doing, but I don't think she wanted to come to a meeting once. And I thought, yeah, I don't know if you're ready or not. We never pursued it. But one of the things I've learned is that when I'm out there and it's like hot and I'm tired and I don't want to run anymore, I know there's a power greater than myself that's picking up the one foot and putting it in front of the other. Last Sunday, I'd been running relatively regularly, a mile or two at a time, and I signed up for a 3.1 mile race, and I'd done one, went very well, it was very easy, and then I thought, oh, well, if it's that easy, I'm going to do another one. So I did one last Sunday. The weather was different. It was a place I'm not familiar with. I don't know. I know I did not finish that in and of my own accord, and that's some of the times where the emotional and the spiritual, it's just like, God, just get me to the end of the race because I can't stand out here and not do anything, and I know that I can finish this. And it's been that way. I didn't talk very much about my mom. My mother is living in a nursing home. She's 85 pounds. She has chronic pulmonary fibrosis. Both of my parents were big kids. My dad never lived more than 2 miles from his mother his entire life. He had his mother until he was 70 years, over 70. And so I had good role models about how to be codependent and take care of your parents. And I know it's codependent, but I'm also very grateful that I'm there to do it for my mom. This November, my mom's health has been getting gradually worse over the last couple of years, and at her birthday time, she turned 82 in November. She was worried she wasn't going to get her driver's license. She took some over-the-counter medicine that ultimately made her very sick, and she's been in and out of hospitals and rehab, and now she's in a nursing home. And it has been through the people in this program that have really, you know, held me together sometimes when, you know, that this thanks, I was, when I feel sorry for myself, I think, I don't know why I'm struggling with my weight. I didn't have Christmas. I didn't have Thanksgiving. I didn't have New Year's. I don't have holidays anymore. I don't have my mom home to cook them for me anymore. And I'm, Julie, you're 49. You should be able to do that kind of stuff. But, you know, at Thanksgiving, she was very, very sick. And I went to see her on Thanksgiving Day. And my mother just, after, she's never had a good filter. And now the filter's just completely gone. They took it out, and I don't think we're ever going to get it back. And she was very sick, and she showed me something that was very, very upsetting to me, and would made me think she's dying, bleeding out right now as we're talking. And you know, it was God that said, you know, she's going to be okay. You're going to get through this. You're going to, you know, you're going to know what to do, or you're going to have people that are going to be able to, you know, to show me what to do. And I'm grateful for, you know, for all of you that have taken phone calls from me when, you know, I think she's dying and things aren't well. And for, you know, Dayla that's been able to give me some direction, and Kay Brown and some of those people that have experience in that area that can say, this is the next right thing. Because in and of my sister and I are not, we're closer now than we ever have been, but we're still not really close, and we're not always seeing eye to eye in all this. So there, between the trials with my mom and the physical stuff where I thought I could, you know, I couldn't do it, that's really been, you know, just shown me that, you know, if you just trust that that it can be done and get out of the way, you can do it. And I can tell you, last Sunday morning, that last mile going back to the finish line for that race, God was carrying me the whole way and just kept saying, just put one foot in front of the other, because I really was frustrated. It was hot. I had nobody else around, and I thought for sure I was going to be the last one in. But it's the courage to start, the perseverance to continue, and the resolve to finish. And I get the courage to start, the perseverance to continue, and the resolve to finish come from a power greater than myself. Because I can make all the lip service about wanting to do those things, but when the rubber hits the road, I'm not always the one that's doing it. So, now we're done.
One more.
Oh, it's after 8 o'clock. Okay. I'm going to expire. I'm like milk. I'll get sour.
So if you've had such dramatic weight loss, people notice. People outside of program notice. Do they ask you about it? Do you tell them what you're doing? I'm just curious.
I'm almost embarrassed to admit I don't think I've ever 12-stepped anybody. Some of the people, a woman that I work with about 6 months or a year ago, asked me what I was doing, and I said, well, you know, I work out at 24 Hour Fitness, and I believe that my relationship with food is akin to someone who has a substance abuse problem like alcoholism or drug abuse, and I've gone to OA for some time. I said, if you're interested, so I took a newcomer packet, put all the stuff in an envelope, wrote a letter, said, this is what I do. If you're interested, please feel free to call me. I would be more than happy to go to a meeting with you. Put it in an envelope marked personal and confidential. Put it in her mailbox at work. Never heard a word from her. You know, so I don't, you know, I've always believed that this has been a program of attraction, not promotion. And I don't know how well I could have attracted people who knew I was going to meetings and watched my weight go from about 125 up to about, you know, 252, because I thought, I wonder how much weight I've really lost, because I went from 230 to about 130 to 252 to about 185, so I don't know. But the different sizes of clothes in my closet are important. One of my favorite things that our speaker last fall said, the disease is not, I have to remember, the disease is not, resides in my mind and not in my thighs. So that's hopefully that will answer your question. Oh, can we turn it off now? Oh, thank you. And I won't cough this time either. Had a joke at the fall retreat.